Well, hello and welcome back to, yes, it's Archaeology News. I do apologise for the great delay in here. It's been a number of things, as you can probably hear. I have not been that well. And then I was off doing field school, where it wasn't so much raining as we spent most of our times in the clouds, but it was great fun anyway. But of course, that just made me more ill. Then we've got Diego being away, internet connections, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I am sure that you are glad to hear my nearly dulcet Scottish tones, hoarse and rough as they sound. It's really good to be back, and so thank you for waiting for so long. So let's get on with it, I hear you say. Get on with the news. Well, there's lots of news to be going on with, so let's start. This news, of course, has been brought to you in partnership between Stone Pages and the British Archaeological Jobs and Resource. All the stories have been collected from various sources, and to view details in each story, including the source, see the Stone Pages website at news.stonepages.com. So what have we got for you? Well, we've got the mysteries of the Neolithic death pit revealed. Sounds exciting. And Neolithic man, was he the first lumberjack? Why can I not get that song out of my head now? Modern culture seems to emerge in Africa 40,000 years ago, and this sounds very exciting. Flying lasers, if not slightly dangerous, have now revealed ancient buried structures. Human evolution in Europe is more complex than previously thought, and there's doubts about the hybridization between humans and Neanderthals. Climate change has shaped ancient burial rituals in Chile and Peru. I found that one a really fascinating one. It's not often you get to hear about what's going on in different parts of the world like this. And they're maybe not the Swan Vesta match, but they are the earliest matches yet identified. That's another cracking story. Another amazing one is an extraordinary sculpture which was unearthed in Turkey. Then we take to the sky again, no lasers involved. It's a good old photography of ancient sites in Denmark. And finally, a story which is very close to my heart. Sitting down all day will not make you fat. Phew, I'm okay then. So let's get on with the mysteries of the Neolithic death pit. Why do you have to say it like that? I suppose you have to say it like that. Neolithic death pit. It's in a new book published recently called Death and Dying in Neolithic Near East. The authors are Dr. Karina Croucher, and she concludes that Neolithic man was not the female-bashing dominant male that popular belief would have us imagine. Her book centres around the discovery of a death pit at a site known as Domuztepe in the southeast corner of Turkey. It's near the border with Iran and Iraq. The death pit was excavated over a period of 6 years in the late 1990s and included signs of feasting with animal bones covered with the remains of up to 40 people, both male and female, in roughly equal numbers, which may have been, wait for it, cannibalised. In addition, the skull of a teenage girl was found who was nicknamed Kim by the excavation team near the edge of the pit and which appeared to have been treated with some care by the same people who were looking after the pit, preventing scavenging animals from picking over the bones. From this and other evidence, I'm glad that she had other evidence as well, Dr. Croucher concluded that a cross-gender comparison has been demonstrated. She is quoted as saying that in the death pit, a specific choice was made to inter these human remains, including Kim, within its context. And undoubtedly, this required care and effort, not only in its construction, but additionally in keeping the area protected and clear of scavengers. Even the cannibalism was probably seen as a people as a compassionate act, she goes on to say. Well, the stereotypical and inaccurate view of the male hunter dominating the more submissive female is an articulation, this is the important bit, of a male bias in archaeology. The question remains, was it during the Neolithic that actually women and males were operating as equals? Well, there's a big discussion to be had there. If you want to get involved in that discussion, then pop along to Past Horizons, where you can find that story and add your voice to it. Pardon me. I promise I will try and make it through to the end of this in one piece. Now, we got to Dr. Ran Barkai of Tel Aviv University's Department of Archaeology and Ancient Near Eastern Civilizations. Well, he's demonstrated a direct connection between the development of an agricultural society and the development of woodworking tools. during the Neolithic period in this area, approximately 10,000 to 6,000 BCE, man evolved from hunter-gatherer to farmer and agriculturalist, living in larger, more permanent settlements with a variety of domesticated animals and plants, bringing significant changes to the economy, architecture and environment. According to Barkai, intensive woodworking and tree felling only appeared with this transition to agriculture and permanent villages. Prior to the Neolithic, there's no evidence of tools that were actually powerful enough to fell trees. Well, there's a statement. The use of woodworking tools over the course of the Neolithic period has not been studied in great detail until now. Through their work at the sites of Motza in the Judean Hills, Dr. Barkai and fellow researchers Professor Rick Yerkes of the Ohio State University and the Dr. Hamoudi Kalai of the Israel Antiquity Authority have unearthed evidence that the increasing sophistication of carpentry tools corresponds with increased agriculture and permanent settlements. The early part of the Neolithic Age is divided into two distinct eras. Right, you bear with me now. They're called Pre-Pottery Neolithic A, or PPNA, and, wait for it, Pre-Pottery Neolithic B, PPNB. Agriculture and domesticated plants and animals appear only in PPNB. Within PPNA, humans remained gatherers but lived in more permanent settlements for the first time. Axes associated with this period are small and delicate, not suited for massive tasks. However, in PPNB, much larger and heavier axes evolve. Barkai also identified a trial and error phase during which humans tried to create an axe strong enough for these larger tasks. Whether the transition to agriculture led to the development of carpentry tools or vice versa, the parallel changes led to the revolution in lifestyle. The round and oval structure of earlier domiciles was replaced by rectangular structures with wooden beams. In addition, people began to produce floors of limestone-based plaster, manufactured by heating limestone. So again, you're going to need wood. So you're needing wood for everything from chopping down trees to creating your structures, a whole host of things, clearing areas actually for agriculture itself. Interesting story. Now, modern culture, the emergence of a clearly recognizable modern culture in our prehistoric past, as reflected by the observable cultural characteristics of modern hunter-gatherer groups, has long eluded scientists and been the subject of great debate. No surprise there. But now researchers have material evidence that a culture much like that of the modern hunter-gatherer San people of Africa existed as long as 44,000 years ago. Until now, most archaeologists thought that the earliest evidence of San hunter-gatherer culture in southern Africa dated back at most 20,000 years. The team dated and analysed objects recovered from Border Cave in the foothills of Lombobo Mountains in KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa. The site has yielded exceptionally well-preserved organic material, making it well-situated for the application of a variety of dating techniques. The artefacts include digging sticks weighted with perforated stones, a wooden stick decorated with incisions used to hold and carry poison, a lump of beeswax mixed with toxic resin, likely used for hafting arrowheads or tools, warthog tusks shaped into awls and possibly even spearheads, and small pieces of stones used as hunting weapons. Lucinda Blackwell of the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg said they adorned themselves with ostrich egg and marine shell beads and notched bones as well. They used these notched bones, sorry, they didn't actually wear the notched bones, they were using these notched bones for possibly counting. They fashioned fine bone points for use as awls and poisoned arrowheads as well. One point is decorated with a spiral groove filled with red ochre, which closely parallels similar marks that the San make to identify their arrowheads when hunting. Paolo Villa, a curator of the University of Colorado Museum of Natural History, another key research team leader and lead study author of a report based on the same research, said that the research itself proves that the later Stone Age emerged in South Africa far earlier than had ever been believed possible and occurred about the same time as the arrival of modern humans in Europe. But differences in the technology and culture between the two areas are very strong, showing that the people of the two regions chose very different paths to the evolution of technology and society. Now, watch out for flying lasers. Archaeology is being revolutionized by remote scanning techniques that use airborne lasers to detect otherwise invisible ground features. This light detection and ranging technology, known as LIDAR, helps scientists record differences in altitude down to a few centimeters. Trees and bushes are no obstacle, as they can actually be calculated out later with a computer. The lasers can even make out structures up to 4 meters underwater. What remains is a three-dimensional image of the Earth's surface, including geometric formations that betray structures hidden beneath the undergrowth. Archaeologists in Germany have already discovered thousands of new sites. For decades, researchers have been studying the Glauberg in the central state of Hesse, where people settled some 7,000 years ago. Over the millennia, the plateau was inhabited by Celts and the Alemanni. In 1996, archaeologists made a sensational discovery of an almost perfectly preserved statue of a Celtic warrior, now known as the Celtic Prince of Glauberg. It was thought unlikely that the mound would yield any more big surprises. But, yes, you guessed it, until an aeroplane flew over it multiple times, sending pulses of laser to the ground and measuring the actual topography, the researchers were stunned. I'd love to have seen a stunned researcher. Amazing. At first glance, they recognized around a dozen potential burial mounds they hadn't known about before. And when they took a closer look at five of them, they were all burial mounds. Archaeo Landscapes Europe is a 5-year project which began in 2010, in which 57 European universities and research centres participated to increase the archaeological use of modern remote sensing technology such as LIDAR, ground-penetrating radar and other electrical and magnetic techniques. The broad potential of remote sensing technology has been highlighted in recent years. You'll probably remember some of these other stories from past podcasts. A team with the Discovery Programme Research Project in Ireland scanned the already heavily researched Boyne Valley with lasers, finding a number of previously unknown small mounds, which are possibly burial tombs, as well as Stone Age earthworks. In an obscure forest near Göppingen in southwest Germany, an entire system of fortifications has been found. The wall, believe it or not, is still 3 to 4 meters high at some points, and it was completely unknown. In a roughly 2,000 square kilometer area of the southern Black Forest, some 3,000 archaeological sites were known. Sounds like a lot? Well, after the LIDAR scan, they now have, wait for it, 36,000 sites. So, I mean, I think it's one of these things where technology can really move us along. But what you still need, yes, is people like myself willing to go out into the field and get their hands dirty and just make sure that that is the case. So I've still got a job. Thank you. A team of scientists maintain that advances in analytical techniques and genetic applications are upending long-held, simplistic views about European human evolutionary history. Recent findings and analyses are indicating that there were actually many climatic, demographic, and cultural events and a diverse group of mechanisms that worked together over time to shape the genetic variation we see today amongst modern Europeans. We're currently at a stage in which next-generation sequencing technologies, ancient DNA analysis, and computer simulation modelling allows us to obtain a much more accurate and detailed perspective on the nature and timing of major prehistoric processes as the colonisation of Europe by modern humans, the survival of human populations during the Ice Age, the Neolithic transition, and the rise and fall of complex societies and empires. These methods and technologies hold the great potential to shed new light on past genetic variation, the onset of major cultural and technological changes that left their imprint on past and present genomes, and potentially on the impact of changes in lifestyle and demography of the appearance of certain diseases and genetic disorders. So you see, it's got real impact and importance for us right now. The following the height of the Ice Age, which was around 27,000 to 16,000 years ago, hunter-gatherer groups began to repopulate most parts of Europe. Then, 8,000 years ago, farming populations began to make their presence on the continent during the Neolithic transition. For several thousand years, two distinctly different modes of life coexisted across Europe: hunter-gatherer populations relying on food resources obtained in the wild, and farming populations practicing domesticated crops, livestock, pottery-making, housing and storage techniques. It's long been theorised that European human genetic diversity formed during the Neolithic transition, but now some scientists are suggesting that it was also shaped before and after that transition. In addition, they say, the expansion of farming is likely to have varied by region, resulting in a more complex mix of farmers and local hunter-gatherers' genetic contributions to European populations. The changing approach to researching human prehistory has made a profound difference in the efforts to understand our human evolutionary past. Well, I won't feel bad if you rewind that bit and listen to it again. It is, I suppose, quite complicated, but remarkably important as we start to refine our understandings of the human story and how we move about and our genetic makeup. Talking of genetic makeup, in the last 2 years, a number of studies have suggested that modern humans and Neanderthals had at some point interbred. Genetic evidence shows that on average, Eurasians and Neanderthals share between 1 to 4% of their DNA. In contrast, Africans have almost none of the Neanderthal genome. The previous studies concluded that these differences could be explained by hybridization, which occurred as modern humans exited Africa and bred with Neanderthals who already inhabited Europe. However, you knew there was a however coming, a new study funded by the BBSRC and the Leverhulme Trust has provided an alternative explanation for the genetic similarities. The scientists found that common ancestry without any hybridization explains the genetic similarities between Neanderthals and modern humans. In other words, the DNA that the Neanderthal and modern humans share can be attributed to their common origin without any recent influx of Neanderthal DNA into modern humans. Dr. Andrea Manica from the University of Cambridge, who led the study, said that their work showed clearly that the patterns currently seen in the Neanderthal genome are not exceptional, are in line with expectations of what could happen without hybridization. So, if any hybridization happened, it's difficult to conclusively prove it never happened. You following us there? Then it would have had been minimal and much less than what people have previously been claiming. Neanderthals and modern humans once shared a common ancestor who is thought to have spanned Africa and Europe about 500,000 years ago. Just as there have been very different populations across Europe today, populations of that common ancestor would not have been completely mixed across the continents, but rather closer populations would have been more genetically similar to each other than populations further apart. Sounds sensible. Then, about 350 to 300,000 years ago, the European range and the African range became separated. The European range evolved into Neanderthal, and the African range eventually turned into modern humans. However, because the populations within each continent were not freely mixing, the DNA of the modern human population in Africa that were ancestrally closer to Europe would have retained more of the ancestral DNA, specifically genetic variants, that is also shared with Neanderthals. On this basis, the scientists created a model to determine whether the differences in genetic similarities with Neanderthals among modern human population, which had previously been attributed to hybridization, could be put down to the proximity of modern humans in northern Africa, who would have later gone on to populate Europe, of course, to Neanderthals. By examining the different genetic makeup among the modern human populations, the scientist model was able to infer how much genetic similarity there would have been between distinct populations within a continent. The researchers then simulated a large number of populations representing Africa and Eurasia over the past 500,000 years and estimated how much similarity would be expected between a random Neanderthal individual and modern humans in Africa and Eurasia. The scientists concluded that when modern humans expanded out of Africa some 60 to 70,000 years ago, they would have brought out that additional genetic similarity with them, making Europeans and Asians more similar to Neanderthals than Africans are on average, completely undermining the theory that hybridization and not common ancestry explained these differences. Again, incredibly complicated, but of course I do find the new genetic stories incredibly difficult to understand, but well worth listening to or reading over and over again to get that nuance, shall we say. Now, a relatively wet climatic period, which I'm afraid I'm suffering just now up in Scotland. I don't think it's actually not rained since April, in fact. Oh, may have triggered the development 7,000 years ago of complex culture in hunter-gatherer communities in the Atacama Desert, including the earliest known examples of ritual mummification. Bands of hunter-gatherers who lived along the Atacama coastline, which is Chile, Peru, from 11,000 BCE to 500 BCE, known as the Chinchorro, began mummifying their dead only around 5,000 BCE. An early archaic burial dated to around about 9,000 BCE that uses similar funerary symbols to the later mummy burials suggests that mummification was a local development rather than being introduced from elsewhere. Now, researchers posit that the cultural innovations, including the cult of mummification, were spurred by environmental change. Regional climate records from the time, based on the periodic appearance of certain plants in the rock records, indicate that there was a period of greater rainfall across the Andes above the Atacama between 5,800 and 4,700 BCE, which would have charged groundwater reserves in the usually dry desert of northern Chile and southern Peru. Springs would have begun discharging water and creeks would have actually filled with water as well. The Chinchorro, who lived in fishing settlements along the coast, would have flourished under these relatively benign conditions. By combining 460 dates from 131 archaeological sites in the Atacama with existing data on how the hunter-gatherer populations fluctuated elsewhere, the scientists developed a model which indicates that the Chinchorro experienced a spike in the population density between 5,000 to 3,000 BCE, which is matching, of course, with the climate records. Ritualistic mummification by the Chinchorro, thought to be in the world's earliest examples, may have evolved as a result of the population increase. Dead corpses, you see, don't decompose in this coastal desert, so an increase in population size means an increase in the corpses that are becoming naturally mummified because of the extremely dry environment. The work builds on the theory that population increases drive technological innovation. The Chinchorro's complicated mummification procedures are a form of ritual technology. The Chinchorro developed various elaborate mummification styles, including painting the skin with red ochre or black manganese, as well as, believe it or not, dissembling the body and putting it back together again. Such complex rituals indicate a complex society, and the period coincides with innovations in fishing tools as well. Around 4,400 years ago, the practice disappears from the region. A flurry of warm El Niño currents decreased marine food sources, and this would have caused the eventual Chinchorro decline. So we also suggest that population drops off, mummification skills are lost in its wake. Climate, you see. Climate and humans, we are very, very linked. Researchers from Israel say that the mysterious clay and stone artifacts excavated from Neolithic levels could be the world's earliest known matches. Although the cylindrical objects, that's easy for me to say, have been known for some time, they have previously been interpreted as, wait for it, cultic phallic symbols. The researchers' new interpretation means that these could be the earliest evidence, being 8,000 years old, of actually how fires were ignited with technology. Although evidence of pyrotechnology in Europe is known from 750,000 years ago, this evidence usually takes the actual remains of the fire itself. But what we have here is evidence that they were using a tool to create fire. Professor Gurren Inbar recognized the shapes of these objects when they went to the Shah Hagolan archaeological site and found that there was a real potential that these were connected to fire drills. She slowly made the connection and then began to do electromicroscopy techniques. And with that, she and her colleagues identified linear marks or striations at the conical end of these cylinders, which they began to interpret as being generated by spinning these, what we'll call matches, within sockets found on fireboards, which are known from other sites. Burn coloration reminiscent of scorch marks was also found, as well as grooves evident higher up on the objects, which could have been generated by a bow used to spin the cylinders. This evidence, the researchers write, is supported by known cultural evidence from the Neolithic, as well as knowledge of traditional fire ignition techniques. This new interpretation highlights the technological sophistication of the Shah Hagolan inhabitants at this time, and the prevalence of these structures around a wide area in the eastern Mediterranean may further indicate that clay matches were common at an earlier time period than any other ignition technology. Now, a beautiful colossal human sculpture is one of the latest cultural treasures unearthed by an international team at the Tayanat Archaeological Project excavation site in southeast Turkey. A large semicircular column base, ornately decorated on one side, was also discovered. Both pieces are from a monumental gate complex that provided access to the upper citadel of Kunulo. I've completely pronounced that wrong, I know. You can write in and shout at me for that. Capital of the Neo-Hittite kingdom of Patina, which is around 1000 to 738 BCE. The head and torso of the human figure, intact to just above its waist, stands approximately 1.5 metres in height, suggesting a total body length of 3.5 to 4 metres. The figure's face is bearded with a beautiful preserved inlaid eyes made of white and black stone, and its hair has been coiffured into an elaborate series of curls. It is absolutely stunning. It's actually well worth Googling to actually see this statue. Both arms are extended forward from the elbow, each with two arm bracelets decorated with lion heads. The figure's right hand holds a spear, and in the left, a sheaf of wheat. A crescent-shaped pectoral also adorns the chest. Behind, there's a lengthy hieroglyphic Luwian inscription carved in raised relief across its back, and it records the campaigns and accomplishments of Supililiumna, likely the same Patinan king who faced the Assyrian onslaught of Shalmaneser III as part of the great Syrian-Hittite coalition in 858 BCE. The Tayanat Gate complex appears to have been destroyed following the Assyrian conquest of the region in 738 BCE, when the area was paved over and converted into the central courtyard of an Assyrian sacred precinct. Since 2009, archaeologists have been using small aircraft to map 9 areas in Denmark that are of particular interest to archaeologists. The project is called The Past as Viewed from the Sky, Air Archaeology in Denmark, and will initially run until 2013. The objective of this project is to gain a clearer view of the ancient monuments in Denmark, and this will spark a greater interest, hopefully, in the past. Of particular interest to the aerial archaeologists are the houses that people once lived in. These house shapes enable archaeologists to clearly determine with great precision which time period they date back to. So far, the project has revealed more than 2,500 sites of archaeological interest, and which could result in further funding for the project. And now, as I said, one that's close to my heart as well. A surprising new study into a comparison of the metabolic rates of modern humans and ancient hunter-gatherers has recently been published in the July edition of PLOS One. That's the Public Library of Science. A brilliant resource, by the way, absolutely free to use as well. The ancient hunter-gatherers used for the comparison were the members of the Hadza tribe from northern Tanzania, whose lifestyle is widely accepted to be as close to a true ancient hunter-gatherer as possible. The team of researchers from Hunter College, University of Arizona, and Stanford University compared the daily expenditure of energy of both the groups. taking into account body weight, body fat percentage, age, and gender. The surprise result was that there was virtually no difference in the metabolic rate of the hunter-gatherer groups or those of an average member of modern-day Western civilization. So maybe a sedentary lifestyle does not automatically lead to obesity. I suspect it's got more to do with Kentucky Fried Chicken and McDonald's, I suppose. Other fast food outlets are, of course, available. These results highlight the complexity of energy expenditure in humans. It's not simply a function of physical activity. Our metabolic rates may be more of a reflection of our shared evolutionary past than our diverse modern lifestyles. Well, on that note, I'm off to hunt down a herd of donuts and sit back and get ready for our next podcast. Of course, you can always keep up with lots of fabulous news at Past Horizons. If you go to www.pasthorizons.com, we've got loads and loads of news from you, as well as some fabulous archaeological tools if you're heading out into the field. And can I also say that you can find loads more on Stone Pages, news.stonepages.com. Thanks so much for listening to the Archaeology News. I hope desperately that we'll be back with you next week.